a lot and has pictures on her phone. His dad looks after him when she's working. I don't think they're rotten poor, but they don't have much money. I keep telling Davina she should get her teeth straightened, but she says she can't afford to look like a supermodel. That's her idea of a joke. Her partner is called Snowden, and he sometimes does odd jobs around Langford Hall because he's good with his hands, particularly fixing motors, which is how he makes his living, doing up cars and flogging them. Every time they hire him, he makes sure the job lasts 4 hours, so he gets a full day rate. Terry Boland liked motors. He used to drive a limousine, one of those posh white ones that are stretched out. In the beginning, he let me ride up front with him, but later, when he had his shitty old Ford Escort, I had to hide in the boot when we travelled. He'd make me curl up in a long zip-up bag, which he slung over his shoulder and carried to the car. I was allowed to undo the zipper when the boot lid was closed. I lay, curled up above the spare tyre, smelling the diesel fumes and oil, and hearing the sound of the road only inches from my face. Terry sometimes took me out of an evening, but it was always in the bag. We'd drive for miles and stop at one of those motorway service centres with a McDonald's or a KFC. He'd park in the darkest corner and let me out of the boot.
"Remember our story,"
he'd say.
"You're my daughter. We're driving to Liverpool to see your grandparents. Your name is Sarah. I'm Peter."
"What's our last name?"
"Jones."
"Where do I go to school?"
"Doesn't matter. Stay close to me. Don't make eye contact with anyone. Don't start a conversation."
I nodded and took deep breaths, enjoying the fresh air. I remember looking up one night, but I couldn't see the stars. I thought they might have all fallen and other people had made wishes, but Terry told me that you don't see stars when you live in London because of all the other lights. He held my hand as we walked into the brightly lit food hall, passing racks of glossy magazines, most of which had Kate Middleton on the cover. She'd married William by then, and people were on baby watch. Terry let me watch the wedding on TV because there was nothing else on. When Kate said, "I do," I wanted the camera to zoom up close on her face, so I'd know if she was lying or thinking, "What am I doing?" Normally, I ordered a cheeseburger because I ate meat back then, and I liked the way the fat coated my tongue. I also had French fries and a chocolate shake. One night, I threw up on the way home, which made Terry angry because he had to wash the mats and the bag. It wasn't my fault. It was the fumes. He didn't take me out again for a long time. And the next time, he gave me drugs to make me sleep. When I'm anxious or nervous, I think of that zip-up bag, because it was somewhere soft and secret and safe. Davina touches my shoulder. I pull away.
"Penny for your thoughts," she says, laughing.
"They'll cost you more than that."
Chapter 26. Slipping a new disc into a DVD player, I fast forward through the early minutes until Craig Farley appears on screen. He's sitting at a familiar table in the interview suite at West Bridgeford Police Station. Anxious, yet eager to please, he sits up straight, occasionally sipping from a can of soft drink. Two detectives are seated opposite him, Primetime and Edgar. Edgar is closer in age to Farley, and they soon discover a shared interest in football, discussing favourite players and premiership results from the weekend. The conversation moves on to pubs and the best ones for pulling a bird. Farley begins to relax because he's not being asked about Jodie Sheehan. He even banters with the detectives, telling a blonde joke that is older than the Bible. The detectives laugh, letting him feel like he's not so different from them.
"You must meet a lot of women at the hospital," says Edgar. "All those nurses."
"Yeah, nothing beats a woman in uniform, eh?" echoes Primetime.
Farley grins and nods enthusiastically.
"Some of them are okay. The young ones, before they get too old and cranky."
"Yeah, the young ones," says Primetime. "You must get plenty of action."
"A bit,"
Only a bit.
Some of them are pretty stuck up, you know. All fur coat and no knickers.
What sort are you like, Craig?
Asks Edgar, dropping his voice to a whisper, as though they're sharing a secret.
I don't like 'em too fat,
says Farley.
Some meat on the bone is okay, you know. And I don't like 'em to be too mouthy or loud.
How'd you meet them?
Asks Edgar.
Farley perks up.
I got Clancy trained.
What?
My dog. I got her trained. She goes up to them in the street and they start patting her and we get chatting and the next thing...
What?
You know.
Is that how you met Jody?
Farley hesitates.
Come on, Craig. You must have seen her around. Everybody seemed to know Jody. She was a champion skater.
Again, nothing.
Where did you see her? Waiting at the tram stop? Walking to school? In the park?
Oh, I never met her.
We found your semen in her hair.
Farley shakes his head, as though refusing to listen to what's being said.
You know about DNA, don't you, Craig? You might as well have written your name and address on a post-it note and stuck it on her forehead.
Oh, I didn't kill her.
Maybe it was an accident,
says Primetime.
How could it be an accident?
Scoffs Edgar.
Maybe she tripped over, hit her head. Was it an accident?
Asks Primetime.
It wasn't me.
Who then?
How would I know?
Maybe you and your mate decided to double team, Jody, and now you're in the shit,
says Primetime.
No.
It's only a matter of time before we catch your mate, Craig, and I'm betting he's going to sing like Susan Boyle, saying it was your idea to follow Jody, to knock her unconscious and take off our clothes.
Farley doesn't know what to say. He's leaning further away from the table, expanding the space between them, going all silent and choked. Edgar and Primetime ease off, letting him recover before starting again. I move through the rest of the interviews, making myself coffee to stay awake. As the hours pass, I see a different man at the table. At first, Farley backtracks, refining his answers, adding extra details or discarding those that haven't served him well so far. But slowly, he is worn down, and his attitude changes. I hear the tension in his voice, and see how his lips narrow into bloodless lines when he's caught lying. Eventually, he stops striving to please his interrogators. He switches to defiance, remonstrating about the wrongness of his arrest or the unfairness of the questions. The interview teams change regularly, taking Farley back over his answers, pointing out the discrepancies. They work together, but often sit apart, making Farley swing his head from side to side as though he's watching a tennis match. Questions are fired quickly, giving him less time to react. His body bends under the weight of the accusations, slouching lower in his chair as he grows more and more despondent.
Come on, Craig. Don't treat us like idiots, says Lenny.
I'm not.
Sure you are. Your mate is going to say that you followed Jody, that you knocked her unconscious, that you pulled down her jeans.
That's all I did.
What?
I pulled down her jeans.
The detectives exchange a glance, trying not to reveal their excitement. Lenny clarifies.
So, you're saying you followed Jody along the footpath?
No.
Where did you first see her?
By the pond.
What was she doing?
She was lying on the ground next to the pond. I thought she might be drunk.
Where were you?
On the footpath.
What did you do?
I wanted to make sure she was okay, you know.
Did you talk to her?
No.
Why not?
She was coughing. I must have frightened her because she tried to run.
You chased her?
No. I mean, I was worried about her.
Who brought the condom?
What?
You used a condom?
No, I tried to help her.
By raping her?
by keeping her warm.
Your semen was found in her hair.
Farley's face crumples and locks in a long grimace.
You have to speak, Craig. For the tape?
He mumbles.
Speak up.
I didn't mean...
What didn't you mean?
To torture,
he says in a hoarse whisper.
I wanted to help her. I did. She was on the ground.
You pulled down her jeans?
I wish I could. I didn't mean to.
His voice breaks and he sobs, rocking in his chair, snot bubbling in his nostrils. As I watch his capitulation, a shape begins to form in my mind. Not a shape, a weight. No, not a weight. A shadow that emerges from the murkiness of the detail. It's as though Craig Farley has fallen into step beside me, and I am seeing the world as he does, feeling the earth beneath his shoes. A lonely, inept young man, the slow kid at school, the last one picked for teams, the butt of jokes, the one too stupid to realise he was being teased. Socially anxious, clumsy, tongue-tied, yet longing to be included. Some boys like this grow more confident with age, or befriend other outsiders, or muddle through life as an afterthought. A few of them suffer depression, sliding into alcohol or drug abuse, hoping stimulants can conquer their low self-esteem. Occasionally, one will develop a pathological desire for perfectionism, losing weight, pumping iron, and growing to hate their former selves for being weak and pathetic. If the rejections and isolation continue, they may grow angry, blaming others for their failures. It's not their fault if they don't have a girlfriend, or a good job, or a nice car, or are still living at home with their parents. All of this I can see, yet I cannot see a killer. Jodie ran from someone, but had no defence wounds. Most likely she was unconscious when Farley removed her jeans, yet she was conscious when she had intercourse. There were no signs of forced penetration. The sequence of events is the key, and I can't make the facts fit the timeline. Unless... Even as the thought occurs to me, I want to dismiss the idea as being too far-fetched. I know what Lenny Pavel will say. She'll laugh and refuse to listen. I have to at least try. I punch out her number. She doesn't answer. It goes to her messages.
Beep.
We need to talk. Chapter 27. Lenny Pavel is walking uphill, going nowhere. Strands of hair are plastered on her forehead, and sweat drips from her nose, landing on the treadmill. Mirrors are everywhere, reflecting her back to me from several different angles, in a room that looks more like a dance studio than a gymnasium. Dressed in silver boxing trunks and an oversized t-shirt, Lenny isn't trying to fit in among the gym junkies in their lycra leggings and brand-name tops. Maybe she doesn't care about fitting in, or what others see when they look at her. I wish I had that confidence. I've been stared at too often, pointed out, talked about.
You're not serious,
says Lenny, looking at me incredulously.
I know everything points to Farley, but what if Jodie was already dead or dying? What if she was semi-conscious when he stumbled across her body?
Her face has turned to stone.
No, no, no.
Hear me out, please. Normally, in a case like this, we'd see signs of control and dominance. The perpetrator becomes sexually aroused. He follows a woman, he abducts her, he instills fear. He rapes, he silences. That's not the right order for this crime.
Lenny presses the stop button and jumps off the ramp, striding away from me. I hurry to keep up.
I know it sounds...
far-fetched. Absurd.
Unusual.
Do you know the chances of a sexual predator happening to stumble across a dead or dying teenager?
She asks.
The chief constable will laugh me out of his office.
Tell him about Violet Jessop.
Who?
In 1911, Violet Jessop was working as a stewardess on RMS Olympic
when it collided with a British warship and almost sank in the Solent. She survived. A year later, she was working on the Titanic when it sank in the Atlantic. Again, she survived.
Is there a point to this?
4 years later, Violet was working as a nurse on a hospital ship, the Britannic, when it hit a German mine and started sinking. She jumped overboard and was sucked under the ship's keel, only to be dragged out of the water with a fractured skull. Again, she survived.
What in God's name are you on about?
I'm saying that stranger things have happened. Bigger coincidences. I think Jodie was already dead or dying when Craig Farley found her. I think someone else fractured her skull and threw her off the footbridge. Lenny grunts scornfully.
It's ridiculous. More to the point, it's dangerous. Farley hit her on the head, raped her, and he left her to die. He confessed, for God's sake.
Turning her back, she climbs onto an exercise bike and begins pedaling, pushing buttons to set the level of difficulty. I hold onto the handlebars as though stopping her from moving. I argue, putting facts in a different order. Jodie was hit from behind and either fell or was pushed into the pond. The shock of the cold water brought her round and she dragged herself onto the bank. She was disorientated, coughing, cold, freezing. She stumbled along the path only to collapse, unable to clear water from her lungs. Her respiratory system failed. If that didn't kill her, it was the sub-zero temperatures. Lenny ignores me, but I know she's listening. Farley is fascinated by pornography and young girls. He has a history of exposing himself. What does someone like that do when he stumbles across an unconscious girl?
Any normal person calls for help.
Farley isn't normal. He undressed Jodie and masturbated over her. Afterwards, he realised what he'd done and panicked. He tried to clean up. He covered her with branches. He went home and dumped his clothes. Lenny is up out of the saddle, pedaling hard. A towel is draped around her neck. Someone had sex with Jodie using a condom, I say.
Farley!
Why would a rapist use a condom and then masturbate into her hair?
He had an accomplice.
Farley doesn't have any friends. Lenny's mouth has tightened into a grim line.
Are you seriously suggesting that two predators, independent of one another, defiled that girl on the same night? One hits her and tosses her off a footbridge, and the other just happens to wander by and say, "What luck, here's an unconscious girl I can masturbate over."
I'm trying to make the facts fit the evidence.
No, you're putting a bomb under my investigation.
She drops her voice to a harsh whisper.
You have to stop it, Cyrus. No more.
You asked me to review the evidence.
And now I want you to shut up and forget everything. Put none of this in writing. We have a confession. We have his DNA. He's our man.
A minute ago, you suggested he had an accomplice.
He didn't.
I'll leave that to the jury. Getting off the bike, Lenny wipes her face on a towel and walks away, heading for the changing rooms. I follow her inside. Several women are in various stages of undress. One of them lets out a cry of surprise and holds a towel across her nakedness.
Are you trying to get arrested?
Lenny asks. What about the money we found in Jodie's locker? We don't know who picked her up that night or how she got to the footpath. Lenny is packing her gym bag. I want to talk to Tamsin Whittaker, I say.
She's been interviewed.
By the police, not by me. Best friends tell each other things. Stuff they hide from adults. Secrets. People keep saying that Jodie was a normal teenager who loved dancing and music and ice skating, but there's more to her than that.
How do you know?
There always is.
Chapter 28.
Are you hungry? I ask.
Evie makes a meh sound.
I could start dinner now.
Whatever.
I begin pulling things out of the fridge, filling a saucepan with water.
You're a vegetarian, right?
So?
Any other dietary requirements?
She shrugs again. That's been the story since Evie arrived. I've experienced the full range of her shrugs, grimaces, and monosyllabic vocabulary. I try again.
What sort of things do you like to eat?
Food doesn't really interest me.
What were the meals like at Langford Hall?
Shit.
Evie is sitting cross-legged on a stool like an Indian swarmy. I strike a match and light the burner, putting on the water to boil. You should learn how to cook while you're here.
Why?
You'll be able to look after yourself when you leave.
I can look after myself.
There is another long silence. I dice onions and garlic, frying them in a heavy-based saucepan. If we're going to live together, we should get to know each other, I say. Let's start with simple things. My favourite song is Things Have Changed by Bob Dylan. How about you?
Goofy's Concern.
Who plays that?
The Butthole Surfers.
Is that a real band?
Yeah.
I don't know if she's being serious. My favourite colour is dark blue, I say. How about you?
Black.
Technically, that's not a colour.
Bite me.
Favourite film, The Shawshank Redemption?
I've seen that one, says Evie.
Did you like it?
No.
Why not?
It gives you all the answers. Nothing is left to wonder about. There's no ambiguity. It ends with happy people hugging on a beach. When does that ever fucking happen?
You don't believe in happy endings?
Every ending is unhappy.
Why?
Because we die.
Ah, you're a fatalist.
A what?
You think we have no power to influence the future and that everything we do is predetermined or pointless because our fate has already been decided?
No, I just know we're going to die.
I can't argue with that. Opening a tin of peeled tomatoes, I empty the contents into the saucepan, breaking them with a wooden spoon, adding torn fresh basil leaves, salt and pepper. The water is boiling. I add the spaghetti and take a block of Parmesan from the fridge, setting it on a plate with a cheese grater. What's your favourite film? I ask.
True Romance.
You like Tarantino?
Who?
Quentin Tarantino. He wrote True Romance. Evie looks at me blankly. I change the subject. What's your favourite food?
Margherita pizza.
Dream holiday destination?
I've never had a holiday.
But you must have somewhere you'd like to go. Greece, Tahiti, America. Her face is a mask. How about your first memory? Mine is getting chased by the big-ass swan when I was feeding ducks with my mother. We were in Henley, near where they have the rowing races.
They race rowboats.
They're a bit more sophisticated than rowboats. Evie looks past me.
My father once took me sailing, she says, as though we found a common interest. He rented a boat and we sailed out past the pier and the bay into the open sea. The wind picked up and so did the waves. I knew Dad was scared, but he didn't want to show it.
Evie grows animated as she describes the waves and the wind and water breaking over the bow. What happened?
We were rescued by a fishing boat and towed back to the pier.
Did you do a lot of sailing?
I don't remember.
This is progress, I think, as I drain the spaghetti in a colander and divide it into bowls. I start spooning sauce onto the pasta. It's then I glimpse a postcard on the fridge. It shows a sailing boat heeling sideways in the wind, water breaking over the bow. Was any of that story true? Evie doesn't respond. You don't have to lie to me.
You don't have to keep asking me questions.
We eat in silence. Evie watches me grate the cheese on my spaghetti. I push it towards her. She sniffs the Parmesan.
Smells like sick.
It tastes better than it smells. She grates a little on her sauce. I watch her take the fork, fill it with pasta, and lift it to her mouth. She closes her eyes and chews, letting out a small moan. Good? She doesn't respond and eats quickly, with one arm on the table, protecting her food like an inmate in a prison canteen. I'm going for a run in the morning. Would you like to come?
Fitness shit, no.
You could look for a job. I could help you put together a CV.
What would I put on a CV?
She's right. Have you thought about going back to school?
It's too late. I've missed too much.
How is your reading?
Okay. I try to learn a new word every day. Today's word is curmudgeon. It means grumpy fucker.
I know what it means. She smiles as though congratulating herself before changing the subject.
You said I could have a mobile phone.
That's not what I said.
Why don't you like them?
I have nothing against mobile phones. I choose not to have one because I prefer to talk to people face to face. As a psychologist, my job is to listen to people and to learn things about them, which I can't do as effectively by reading a text or tweet.
It doesn't seem very professional, says Evie.
I have a pager. People contact me. I call them back.
You vet your calls.
That's not the reason. Evie studies my face, searching for the lie, but cannot find one. Having cleaned her plate, Evie gets up from the table and turns to leave. I remind her about helping with the chores. She looks around the kitchen.
Where's the dishwasher?
I don't have one.
How do you wash stuff?
The old-fashioned way. I pull out detergent, rubber gloves, and a scouring pad. Evie turns on the taps, squirting detergent into the running water. You should do the glasses first, I say. Ignoring me, she picks up a plate, which slips from her fingers. She attempts to catch it in midair, but it slips again and shatters on the tiled floor, sending shards in every direction. Evie glares at me as though it was my fault, and then I notice a different emotion. Despair. Loss. It's only a plate, I say, getting a dustpan and brush. No harm done. Evie turns away, not wanting to show any sign of weakness. Eventually, she confronts me with a new allegation.
Stop staring at me.
What?
You keep staring at me. You're like all the others, the shrinks and therapists and social workers. You want to reach inside my head and hook your fingers in the cracks and open me up, see what makes me tick.
That's not true. Evie snorts, recognizing my lie.
Have you ever considered the possibility that I don't need to relive my past or explore my feelings? I don't need to be fixed because I'm not fucking broken.
Chapter 29. Angel Face.
The old house is speaking to me. With every creak and groan, I imagine Cyrus standing in the corridor outside, the soft noise of his breathing, his timid knock, the door opening, light falling across the floor. I climb out of bed and brace my shoulder against the chest of drawers, pushing it across the bare wooden floorboards until it rests hard against the door. Returning to the bed, I reach beneath the pillow, searching for the knife I took earlier when I was washing the dishes. At Langford Hall, they count every utensil after mealtimes, even the potato peelers, but Cyrus didn't bother to check. I close my eyes but cannot sleep. I'm not used to this. For years I have lived in places where the doors were locked and the lights were dimmed, where CCTV cameras monitored my waking hours, and the heating was controlled by a central switch, and the water could be cut in the showers if I tried to block the drains. At 7:45 each morning I would press a buzzer and ask to come out. Most mornings the doors unlocked immediately, but occasionally I was kept inside my room until whatever emergency had passed. Cyrus hadn't locked any doors or demanded the lights be turned off. I'm not his prisoner. I can wander down to the kitchen to grab a bite. I can walk outside and dance under a streetlight and nobody would stop me. Maybe that's what's keeping me awake. The choices. I get out of bed again, open my bag, and take out the marbles and the piece of coloured glass and the button belonging to my mother. Finally, I come to an envelope of cash. Smoothing out the duvet, I count out the notes, separating them into different piles, 10, 20s, and 50s, £2,580 in total. My eyes come to rest on an old armchair in the corner. It's covered in a faded floral fabric that is worn smooth where countless arses have sat. Rolling the chair onto one side, I study the stapled upholstery and the stitching before taking the knife and carefully picking apart a seam, working the blade back and forth until I create a pocket big enough to hold the cash. Once I'm finished, I return the chair to the corner and go back to bed, lying still, breathing slowly. That's when I hear the noise, the clang of metal on metal, and a guttural groan as though an animal is caught in a trap. Crossing the room, I lean over the drawers and press my ear against the door. Clang, clang, clang. It's coming from below me, downstairs, the basement. I want to investigate. I want to stay in bed and cover my head with a pillow, blocking out the sound. I push aside the drawers and step onto the landing, clutching the knife. I pause for a moment and listen. There it is again. The moaning. Metal striking metal. Descending slowly, I follow the noise, running my fingers along the wall to feel my way forward. Every floorboard is like a tripwire, ready to give my presence away. Light spills from a room. Creeping closer, I peer around the edge of a door and draw back suddenly. Then I look again, half in fear and half in fascination. An ink-stained figure is hunched beneath a metal bar that curves across his shoulders, bearing coloured plates the size of hubcaps at either end. The figure squats and rises, his thighs trembling and his breath coming in short bursts. He does it again and again, each lift slower and harder than the last, until he groans and drops the weight onto a cradle. His chest and arms are covered in an aviary of swallows, sparrows, hummingbirds, doves, lorikeets, and robins. The birds move as he moves, animated by the muscles beneath his skin and the beads of sweat that trickle in rivulets down his neck and chest. Cyrus turns to pick up a bottle of water. I see his back, which is covered by an enormous set of folded wings that stretch from his upper arms, across his shoulders, down either side of his spine where they disappear beneath his shorts and reappear on his thighs. Each feather is so beautifully drawn and finely detailed that I can make out every barb and vein, so lifelike that I can imagine him arching his back, unfurling his wings, and taking flight. Cyrus adds more weight to the bar before ducking underneath and bracing it across his shoulders. He tries to straighten, moans. Nothing happens. It's too heavy. He tries again. This time the bar rises a fraction of an inch. Then more. Veins bulge in his arms, and his face darkens with blood. This is not exercise. This is self-abuse. This is punishment. I'm willing him to stay upright, but his knees are buckling. He staggers, sways. I catch my breath, sure that he'll fall, but Cyrus steadies and lowers the bar with painful slowness. It hovers over the cradle for a moment before dropping, and he collapses onto a bench, his head draped over his splayed knees. I back away, feeling like a voyeur, or worse, a thief. Returning to the bedroom and my new bed, I don't bother pushing the chest of drawers against the door.
Chapter 30. Felicity Whittaker answers my knock with such a flourish that I'm sure she's expecting someone else. Squeaking in surprise, she touches her face almost instinctively, as though caught without her makeup. She's in old jeans and a sweatshirt, her hair tied up in a scarf.
I was cleaning.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Don't be. Any excuse?
She pulls off her scarf and pushes a stray lock of hair behind her ear. She's someone who favours jewellery that dangles and clinks. Housework can be very therapeutic, I say. It gives me a sense of achievement.
I thought you'd have a cleaner.
No.
A wife?
No. Felicity raises her eyebrows, and I wonder if she's flirting. I'm still standing on the doorstep. Apologising, she steps back, pushing a vacuum cleaner away with her foot. I squeeze past, almost brushing against her. She could give me more room.
The kitchen table is covered in boxes of cereal and bowls of soggy flakes.
We slept in this morning,
she explains, pointing to a chair.
Can I get you a cup of tea?
Thank you.
She fills the kettle. I notice an array of postcards magnetized to the fridge with plastic fruit. Images from New Orleans, Sydney, Mexico City, and Berlin.
Have you been to all these places?
Heavens no, she laughs. They're from my pen friends. I've been writing to some of them since I was 11. My primary school started a program. We were matched up with children around the world.
She is clearing the table as she talks.
One day, when I win the national lottery, I'm going to visit them all, take a world tour. I know it's a silly dream.
It's not silly.
Through the door in the sitting room, I notice a gangly-looking youth with an electric guitar on his lap. He's wearing headphones, and his fingers are flicking up and down a fretboard, making music that only he can hear. A girl is lying with her head next to his thigh, peering at her phone.
My eldest, Aidan,
says Felicity, smiling.
I think the girl is Sophie, but I could be wrong. She's here to comfort him. My children have become more popular since Jodie's death.
She gives me a guilty look.
That's probably a terrible thing to say.
Aidan dips the guitar and drives to a head-rocking crescendo.
Is he in a band? I ask.
God forbid, no,
she laughs.
He's reading law at Cambridge next year. He won the Charter Scholarship, fully funded.
That's brilliant.
Isn't it, though? We're so proud of him.
She's opening cupboards, searching for something. Finally, she retrieves a packet of biscuits that is tucked behind cake tins and Tupperware boxes, hidden from her children.
It isn't easy getting out of this place. A lot of Aidan's friends have gone straight from school onto the dole or get trapped in dead-end jobs at call centres or franchise stores. They get some girl pregnant or married too young out of boredom or go into the family business, having promised themselves they never would. Not my Aidan. He's going to be a lawyer in a big London firm with a house in Hampstead and a villa in Italy.
Sounds like you have it all planned out.
Felicity laughs, and her earrings sway.
Where did you meet Brian? I ask.
On the ice. I fell over. He picked me up. Cheesy, I know. It was my 19th birthday. I was with a group of girlfriends, but I forgot about them completely as Brian held me around the waist and we skated. He made me feel like we could be Torval and Dean.
Did he ever compete?
For a while, but he didn't have the support to make it to the top. Instead, he turned to coaching. He taught Jodie how to skate. She took to it like a...
She looks for the right phrase.
Do penguins skate?
I don't know.
Well, she was a natural.
Felicity opens the biscuits and arranges them on a plate.
People think figure skating is graceful and gentle, but you have to be hard as nails to survive. The injuries, the falls. Jodie could be a proper little madam when she lost a competition, blaming everyone but herself. The judges, Brian, her mum.
She jiggles tea bags in two mugs.
My sister-in-law is a complete saint. I can't remember the last time she bought a new dress or had a holiday or got her hair done, but Jodie always had a new costume. Her skates cost £1,000 a pair, and she needed new ones every year. And don't forget the ballet lessons, gymnastics, physio and choreography. Brian was coaching her for free, but it still cost a fortune.
Felicity tucks hair behind her ear. It falls across her cheek immediately. Aidan yells from the living room.
Hey, Mum, get us a Red Bull.
Get it yourself. I have company.
Aidan mutters sullenly and appears in the kitchen. It's the first time I've seen him up close. He has an almost genderless face, full of straight lines and sharp angles, except for large eyes and long dark lashes that brush his cheeks when he blinks. It gives him a strangely androgynous beauty.
This is Cyrus Haven,
says Felicity.
He works with the police.
Are you a detective? A psychologist. Nice to meet you, he says, without offering to shake my hand.
Instead, he takes a can of Red Bull from the fridge and goes back to the sofa and his guitar. The girl dangles her legs across his lap. Aidan pushes her feet away. She tries to nuzzle his neck, but he's not interested. Eventually, she picks up her phone and curls up on the opposite end of the sofa, looking bored. Felicity settles again,
curling her fingers around the mug and blowing gently across the top.
I thought Jodie would be fine, you know. She was going to make something of her life. She'd skate to Olympic glory, become famous and cash in.
Is there money in skating?
Oh, yes. She could have become a TV presenter or done Disney on Ice shows in Las Vegas or gone on Strictly. If I'd been given even a tenth of her talent.
She doesn't finish the statement, but I catch the hint of regret in her voice. What was your ambition? I ask. She smiles wistfully.
I'm not the ambitious type. I did once think of applying to British Airways to become a flight attendant, but then I met Brian. We both wanted kids, but it proved harder than we hoped.
In what way?
I struggled to get pregnant. We used up all our savings on IVF. Maggie had Felix by then, and I felt like such a failure. I didn't have a career, and I couldn't have a baby.
What happened? She glances towards the sitting room.
Aidan came along, like a gift from God. I was so relieved. Sometimes at parties when women ask me what I do, I feel guilty about being a stay-at-home mum and not having had a career. But I'm good at this. It's all I ever wanted. It's enough.
The fridge rattles to life, as though punctuating the statement. I was hoping to ask you about Jodie, I say.
I thought the police had arrested someone.
They still have to prepare a case. Felicity nods. You watched her grow up, I say.
I was like her second mum.
What was she like?
Precious.
I struggle with terms like precious, or treasure, or princess, because they tell me nothing. I need more. Was she flirtatious, brash, self-assured? Or was she quiet, withdrawn, or self-conscious?
She was very good to our Tasman, says Felicity.
In what way?
Teenage girls can be very cruel. Tasman has been bullied since year six. Don't ask me why. I know she's not the prettiest girl and she isn't sporty or coordinated. Her dance teachers used to hide her in the back row whenever they did recitals. But my girl has a good heart.
Her voice has grown thick and she looks at her tea as though she's forgotten whether she sugared it or not.
Jodie stood up to the bullies. She made sure Tasman was included.
Can I talk to Tasman? Felicity glances at the ceiling.
She's upstairs now. Some girls from school dropped round. They brought flowers.
I notice a ragged bunch of carnations in a vase.
It's ironic, really.
What is?
The same girls who used to exclude Tasman now want to be her best friend. I'm not stupid. I know they're up there now, pumping her for details, wanting to be involved.
As if summoned by a bell, I hear running above my head and jostling on the stairs. Three teenage girls appear.
We're hungry,
says Tasman, reaching for the biscuits. Felicity slaps her hand away.
They're for guests.
I got guests.
I could toast some crumpets.
Tasman looks at her friends hopefully, but the signals aren't good. Felicity points to a fruit bowl.
We have apples and a sad-looking banana.
It's brown, says Tasman.
It tastes the same.
The taller of her friends is wearing a clingy top and a short denim skirt. Loitering in the doorway, she's trying to catch Aidan's attention, but he doesn't look up.
Hi, Aidan,
she says finally.
Hi, Brianna,
he replies, glancing at her briefly before going back to his guitar. The girl on the sofa glares at Brianna in response.
This is Dr. Haven,
says Felicity.
He's working with the police. He wants to ask you some questions about Jodie.
Brianna immediately forgets Aidan and focuses on me.
Are you a detective?
A psychologist.
I'm Olive,
says the other girl, not wanting to be left out. She has doll-like eyes and blonde hair that curls in ringlets to her shoulders. They're both prettier than Tasman, and she's self-conscious around them.
Did Jodie have lots of friends, or just a few close ones? I ask.
We were her best friends,
replies Brianna, who is clearly the queen bee.
Was she a leader or a follower? I ask. The girls look perplexed. I haven't framed the question well. I try again. When the latest must-have fashion came out, who would get it first?
Me,
says Brianna. Okay, and if someone dared you to do something crazy, who's most likely to take up the dare?
Jodie,
says Tasman, speaking for the first time. And if you were deciding what to do on the weekend, who came up with the ideas?
Jodie,
she says again. What sort of things did she like to do?
She was a really good figure skater,
says Olive, wanting to add something.
Duh! Everybody knows that,
says Brianna. What else?
She liked dancing,
says Olive, looking hurt.
Yes, dancing,
says Brianna.
She took classes, didn't she?
They look at Tasman, who nods. What kind of foods did she like, I ask.
Pizza and chocolate brownies and fruit smoothies,
says Brianna, clearly making things up.
She wasn't allowed to eat pizza,
says Felicity.
Maggie kept her on a strict diet.
She ate pizza sometimes,
counters Tasman.
When Aunt Maggie wasn't around.
What else did she do in secret? I ask. They glance at each other, less sure of the conversation. Did she have a boyfriend?
Toby Leith,
replies Brianna.
He's in year 12.
Tasman shakes her head.
Jodie thinks he's an F-boy.
A what?
Felicity asks. Tasman blushes and looks at the floor.
A guy who only wants one thing,
explains Brianna, nudging Olive. Were Jodie and Toby seeing each other?
They used to hook up.
It was one time, protests Tasman.
It was more than once. First at Shelley Pollard's party, then at the Goose Fair.
And at the movies,
adds Olive.
That day we saw Infinity War.
Was Toby at the fireworks? I ask. All the girls nod. Did Jodie talk to him? Tasman hesitates.
Toby was teasing her. He snatched her tote bag and wouldn't give it back.
What did Jodie do?
She slapped him in the face, but he just laughed. That's when Father Patrick showed up.
Father Patrick?
Our parish priest,
explains Felicity.
He made Toby give the bag back,
says Tasman. Did Jodie talk to anyone else?
Loads of people. They were coming up to her all night.
Why? Tasman shrugs. Brianna grins at Olive, and I sense an in-joke. I focus on Tasman. Why did Jodie leave the fireworks?
Someone sent her a text and she said she had to go.
Who?
I don't know.
Did you know that Jodie was carrying a second phone?
No.
You told the police that Jodie went to get fish and chips?
That's what she told me.
Did you know that she had a second mobile phone? Tasman doesn't answer. Could she have arranged to meet someone?
I guess.
A new boyfriend? Tasman looks at her mother with a hurt helplessness in her eyes.
I put some pyjamas on her pillow. I thought she'd come back to ours, but she didn't.
Her bottom lip trembles. When you woke and saw the bed was empty, what did you think? Tasman is about to say something, but Felicity interrupts.
We assumed she'd gone home.
Is that what you thought? I ask Tasman. She nods. Did you look for her?
Yes.
Where did you go? Her mouth opens and closes. She swallows. She looks at her hands.
I went to Toby's house. I thought Jodie might have gone there.
But you said she didn't like him.
She sort of didn't, but I knew she still did, you know?
Did you see Toby? She shrugs and mumbles.
he was with someone else.
Fuck boy,
whispers Brianna under her breath. Where would I find Toby Leith? I ask.
At the skate park. He's there all the time,
says Brianna. Olive raises her hand as though we're in a classroom.
Did someone rape Jody? Is that why...
She doesn't finish. What makes you ask? She shakes her head, losing confidence. Felicity visibly stiffens.
I'm not sure the girls need to know the details.
The police also found condoms in Jody's school locker, I say.
I knew it,
says Brianna, grinning wickedly.
You don't get a guy like Toby unless you're putting out. Please don't talk about Jody like that,
says Felicity.
I'm only telling the truth,
whines Brianna.
I think you girls should leave.
No,
complains Tasmin.
It's time the girls went home.
Brianna tosses her hair.
Come on, Olive. This place gives me the creeps.
They're in the hallway, but Brianna can't resist a parting shot, this one directed at me.
People keep making Jody out to be some sort of Disney princess, all pure and innocent. You should talk to her brother.
Why? Another laugh, another toss of her hair, and I feel like I'm 14 again, with braces on my teeth and a pimpled face that betrayed every humiliation like a magic eight ball. Chapter 31. The girls have gone by the time I get outside. I wonder how much of their provocative posturing and the sly nudges were designed to shock me. When I was their age, I found girls intimidating because they seemed to be so much more self-aware and confident, capable of destroying me with a single shrug, or curl of a top lip, or toss of their hair. One girl in particular, Karen Hines, terrorized me more than the rest. Most of my schoolmates felt sorry for me after what had happened to my family. But Karen took it upon herself to belittle and humiliate me at every opportunity, as though she resented my tragic fame. I wish I could put it down to hormones, or a shitty home life, or a period that lasted until A-levels, but Karen was simply a bitch, and I hate the fact that I still hate her. Retracing my steps to Silverdale Walk, I pass the footbridge and turn left at the fork, crossing the meadow and the tram tracks before emerging at the edge of Forsyth Academy. The asphalt path is crumbling in places and partially covered in fallen leaves. 10 minutes later, I reach Clifton, a slightly more upmarket area with neater gardens, newer cars and fewer abandoned supermarket trolleys. Keeping the school grounds to my left, I follow Farnborough Road until I reach a sign for Clifton Skate Park. A dozen teenagers are riding the concrete ramps, curved walls and jumps. I catch a whiff of something herbal in the air. One of them looks at me petulantly as he drags on a soggy spliff. Like the others, he's wearing an unofficial uniform, baggy jeans, a sweatshirt, and a baseball cap. I approach the nearest group, one girl, four boys. I'm looking for Toby Leith.
And who are you?
Asks the girl, trying to show her street cred by taking the lead. A boy makes an oinking sound. The others laugh. But one glances over his shoulder, and I know that Toby Leith must be nearby. A second group is racing BMX bikes on a series of parallel tracks that rise and fall over concrete jumps. Which one is he? I ask. The girl whistles. Decks are kicked into fists and bikes are propped on one foot. I pick out Toby because he's helmetless and hatless and cockier than the rest. Ignoring the signal, he rises on his pedals and drops almost vertically down a ramp, accelerating along the flat bottom and getting airborne as he takes each jump. When he reaches the far end, he rockets up a steep incline and spins in midair before landing with both wheels on the top of the ramp, 50 yards away. Can we talk? I yell.
You a reporter?
I'm a psychologist.
I don't need a shrink.
I work with the police.
I already talked to the pigs.
Then you know all the answers. I look over the edge at the vertical drop. It's easier if you come to me.
I can hear you from here.
I hear Jody was your girlfriend.
I don't have a girlfriend.
Your ex, then? Toby looks at me, blankly.
Just because I finger-bang a girl at a party doesn't mean we're engaged.
The others laugh. Toby runs his hand through his hair, pushing it behind his ears, grinning. You're talking about a girl who was murdered, I say, and I see his bravado fade away. She was also only 15, a minor.
She was 16.
Afraid not. Toby shrugs, less certain than before. Rocking onto the pedals, he balances the bike on two wheels and leans his weight forward, dropping into the void, aiming his body at where I'm standing. Exploding off the edge, he catches the bike in midair, only inches from my face. He's testing me. I don't flinch.
What's this really about?
He mutters. You saw Jodie at the fireworks.
So?
You were teasing her. She slapped your face.
Whoa! Whoever told you that is lying.
Did you arrange to meet her later?
No.
Did you send her a text?
No.
Did you pick her up in your car?
You deaf or something?
There are witnesses, Toby. You were seen with Jodie. You took her bag, she hit you.
Okay, I saw her, so what?
I think you bumped into her again outside the fish and chip shop on South Church Drive. She knocked a can of beer from your hands. He doesn't respond. What did you say to Jodie that made her so angry? Toby leans hard on the handlebars, as though trying to crush the bike or push it into the ground.
I was drunk. I invited her back to my place. I guess I was a little crude.
He blinks at me sadly.
I didn't mean any of it, you know. I wish I could take it back.
Chapter 32. Angel Face.
I'm standing at the bay window, peering through the curtains. People are coming and going along the road, children being walked to school, a street sweeper with a barrow and a broom, a postman with a trolley. I'm on my third can of lemonade since breakfast, and the sugar rush feels good. Why so many? Because I can. I could have had a beer if I wanted. I could pour myself a scotch. I thought about it, but gagged when I cracked the lid and took a sniff. When Cyrus left this morning, I opened the front door and stepped outside. Twice. Outside. Inside. Outside. Inside. Then, I immediately locked the door, latched the chain, and went through the rest of the house, securing every window. I drew the curtains and closed the blinds. I studied the eaves and cornices, making sure that Cyrus hadn't been lying when he told me there weren't any cameras. Opening a packet of chocolate biscuits, I start exploring the house properly, starting in the basement, where Cyrus has his weight room. His towel is still damp from last night. I run my fingers along the bar and try to lift it from the cradle, using both hands, but it won't budge. I try raising one side. It still doesn't move. In the sitting room, I turn on the TV and pick up the remote. Where are all the channels? Doesn't he have satellite or cable? The next room is the library. Why does anybody need so many books? Has he read them all? I pick out a heavy volume bound in brown leather, spelling out the word Britannica on the spine. It has columns and drawings, like a dictionary with pictures. I open a page and read, sounding out the words. Annie Oakley. Original name, Phoebe Ann Mosey. Born August 13th, 1860. Dark County, Ohio, US. Died November 3rd, 1926. Greenville, Ohio. American markswoman who starred in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, where she was often called Little Sure Shot. I turn to another page. George M. Pullman. In full, George Mortimer Pullman. Born March 3rd, 1831, Brockton, New York, US. Died October 19th, 1897, Chicago. American industrialist and inventor of the Pullman sleeping car, a luxurious railroad coach designed for overnight travel.
There are so many volumes of the Britannica that I wonder if everybody has something written about them. I look up other names. Cyrus Haven, Adam Guthrie, Terry Boland, but none of them are mentioned. The library has a polished wooden desk with drawers on either side, and a lamp that curls over the top. The leather chair creaks under my weight. Picking up a pen, I click it open and closed with my thumb. There is a pile of invoices awaiting payment. Electricity, gas, internet. According to a bank statement, Cyrus has £1,262 in his current account. He also has a double-barreled surname, Haven Sykes, but only uses one of his names. I pick up a padded envelope and shake the contents onto the desk. There are 6 DVDs in plastic cases, each of them stamped with the words Nottinghamshire Police. Opening one of them, I read the label. It has a number, a date, and a name. Craig Farley. I glance at the DVD player in the corner before putting everything back where I found it. Having searched the ground floor, I climb the stairs and go to the main bedroom, where the bedclothes are rumpled and thrown haphazardly back into place. I imagine Cyrus lying in the bed with one hand resting on his chest and the other shielding his eyes. I want to ask him about each of his tattoos. What they mean. Did they hurt? Does he like pain? I open his wardrobe. He has 4 pairs of jeans, 6 shirts, 2 jumpers, a vest, a blue blazer, and a black suit in dry cleaning plastic. One of the shirts is denim with studs for buttons. I put it on and roll up the sleeves. It looks good on me, almost like a jacket. Cyrus has a drawer for his socks and another for t-shirts and running shorts. He has 4 pairs of shoes, including hiking boots. I put them on, feeling like a child wearing my father's shoes, although I can't remember if I ever did that. I have almost no memories of my father, a man in an armchair by the fire, sitting on his knee, listening to him read. "Have you brushed your hair and combed your teeth?" he'd ask, making the same joke every night, rubbing his stubbly jaw against my cheek. My mother is clearer, but even those memories are beginning to fade, or fray at the edges, losing colour and detail, like the old rug on Cyrus's floor. I have one memento, a tortoiseshell button. It came from her favourite coat, which was bright red with a fur-lined collar, and she wore it on special occasions. She was wearing it when I last saw her. I wouldn't let go. I clung to her, and the button came away in my hand. I screamed for her then. I wish for her now. I hold that button in my fist, believing it might bring her back if I have enough faith. Putting the room back in order, I go to the bathroom and search the cabinet above the sink. Opening jars and bottles, I sniff at the contents. There are no pills or medications, but Cyrus has condoms, a whole box, unopened. I close the cabinet and look in the mirror. I hate what I see. I hate my lank hair. I hate my downturned mouth. I hate my fat bottom lip. I hate the freckles on my nose. I hate my sticky out ears. I hate my skinny legs. The doorbell rings. My heart jumps. I go downstairs and wait in the hallway. The bell rings again. I look through the spy hole. There are 2 young men in cheap suits. They look no older than me. I open the door a few inches.
"Hello, how are you today?"
one of them says brightly.
"What a lovely old house."
There's no hint of sarcasm.
"Do you believe in God?"
"No."
"What do you believe in?"
"Nothing."
"Do you know much about Jesus Christ?"
"Who are you?"
"We're from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we're here to share the message of Jesus Christ. My name is Elder Grimshaw, and this is Elder Green."
"Doesn't that get confusing?" I ask, both being called Elder.
"We're missionaries."
I thought missionaries were supposed to work in poor countries.
"No, We're everywhere. We share our experiences because we believe in helping others to find peace and fulfillment in the love of Jesus Christ. Would you like to learn more?
No.
We're here to share.
You want to change my mind? That's not sharing. The two Mormons look at each other. I have my foot braced against the door, ready to slam it closed. The quieter of the two is waiting for his partner to take the lead. I look at him. Do you truly believe that God exists?
With all my heart.
No. I think your mate does, but you're not so sure. Come back when you are. I shut the door and go back upstairs, continuing my search of the house. The upper floor rooms are supposed to be off limits, according to Cyrus. That was a mistake. Who is going to ignore a challenge like that? Most of the rooms are full of old furniture and rolled up rugs and boxes of magazines and sheet music and photographs. I wonder how many generations of people have lived here. How many have died? The loneliness of the house is seeping into me, and I wish Cyrus would come home, even though he'll want to know what I've been thinking behind my mask, or want to squeeze my skull and shake things out. Having searched the turret room, I go to the small dirty window and peer out at the near-empty street, and at the houses opposite, and the parked cars, and the rooftops beyond. A woman pushes a pram along the pavement. A cyclist sweeps past her. From somewhere behind me, I hear Terry's warning.
You must never tell anyone who you are.
I won't.
Promise me.
I promise.
Chapter 33. As I near the Sheehan house, a neighbour appears at his front gate sitting astride a mobility scooter. Rolls of fat cascade over his belt, making it hard to see where his legs begin.
Are you with the police?
He asks aggressively. No. I don't stop. He follows, accelerating to my pace. I recognise him from his photograph. Kevin Stokes, the former swim instructor who served 8 years for sexually abusing two boys at a local swimming centre.
Yes, you are. I saw you the other night. When are they going to clean this up?
He nods towards his house where the words pedo and pervert have been daubed in red paint across his front fence. I don't stop.
What about my rights?
He yells. What about the boys you abused? I mutter, under my breath. A police officer answers the door at the Sheehan house. Female, uniformed. Is anyone home? I ask.
Mrs. Sheehan has gone to church.
And Mr. Sheehan?
He left early this morning.
The constable jots down the address of a nearby church and draws me a map on a scrap of paper. I follow her directions until I see the steeple from two streets away. The main doors are locked, so I try a side entrance and enter a nave with a vaulted ceiling crisscrossed by white beams that join together and plunge down pink-tinted walls. Seats are arranged on three sides around an altar. Maggie Sheehan is cutting flowers and arranging them into tall vases. She has a warm, open face, with a high forehead and pale blue eyes. She's an introvert. I recognised that when I first saw her deferring to Dougal, letting him speak first, almost seeking permission with her eyes before she voiced an opinion. It was as though she had grown accustomed to being in the background, and I could imagine how easily she could disappear, fading into the wallpaper, or evaporating without leaving so much as a spot.
I'm sorry to bother you, Mrs. Sheehan, I say, clearing my throat. Do you remember me?
Dr. Haven.
Cyrus.
She goes back to trimming the flowers.
We've been sent so many, I thought I should bring some to the church,
she explains.
People are very kind. I do the flowers every week, and clean the presbytery for Father Patrick.
I called on Felicity earlier, I say. It must be a comfort having her living so close.
She's like a sister to me. People used to think Brian and I were twins, but he's 2 years younger. I remember when he first brought Felicity home to meet our parents.
he whispered to me. I'm going to marry this one. And he did.
She snips another stem.
I was engaged to Dougal by then. We talked about a joint wedding, but I fell pregnant and we had to rush up the altar. Does that shock you?
No.
I guess it doesn't matter so much anymore. Sex before marriage, a pregnant bride. Felicity was my birth partner because Dougal didn't want to see the nuts and bolts. That's what he called it. I promised that I'd do the same for Flip, but she took ages to fall pregnant.
Flip?
That's my pet name for her. It almost drove her mad, the IVF and the heartbreak. Then, a miracle. Aidan came along. Did you meet him? Isn't he gorgeous? So kind.